This presentation will be about adaptation to climate change, and it's going to start out by saying we need both adaptation and mitigation. So mitigation is what we were talking about last night, methods of reducing the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And actually, from two nights ago, we talked a little bit about geoengineering, which is kind of after the fact, putting dust way up in the atmosphere to block out some of the sunlight. And I think I sort of presented that that's a risky way of counting on doing things. And it, you know, we know ahead of time that it leaves behind several problems. But anyway, the outline for tonight, why both mitigation and adaptation, science challenges for adaptation, a few potential examples out of really an infinite variety. The applications of adaptation are much more local, so the variety of things that you're adapting for and the variety of possible solutions and locations are much greater. And then education policy and empowerment for adaptation. Who gets to make the decisions about it, and who should really be informed about it? So the overall theme is that adaptation requires a more case-by-case approach than mitigation. It's going to happen on a more local level and have a whole lot larger variety of applications. So why both? This wording comes from a report of the National Academy of Sciences, I believe. I didn't actually look up the credit for this, but adaptation is to manage the unpreventable, and actually I kind of reverse this. Mitigation is to prevent the unmanageable. So those two in combination should prevent sort of the most dire of consequences. And adaptation is generally less time sensitive, but if you wait too long, there are risks to it. So hopefully you've got some amount of mitigation mixed in there as well. One of the science is more difficult for adaptation, primarily because it works at a local scale. And as we discussed on Wednesday, when you're looking at a local scale or something that has kind of more links in the chain of causes between greenhouse gases and the effect that you're looking at, there's a greater degree of uncertainty in what's going on. So you've got uncertainty in the impacts that you're trying to adapt to, and then what I'm calling efficacy of the adaptive measure, how much effect is what you're doing as an adaptation having to prevent this. Both of those pieces are uncertain. So the science is a little more challenging, but one of the advantages from the previous slide is that it can be more reactive. You can adjust your adaptation in most cases, and you know, see how it's working and fine tune. So one example that's been thrown around quite a bit, and this paper is really only one of the examples of people talking about the mountain pine beetles. This is kind of a standard example of impacts and potential for adaptation. These have spread into British Columbia and really infested a lot of the forests there and killed a whole lot of trees. So the thing in the lower right is an aerial shot that shows a whole bunch of the trees there have turned red, And the reason that's given for this is warming temperatures there that allow these mountain pine beetles to reproduce effectively in the new climate of this region. So if you see the map on the right there, they've spread from the US side of the border and into British Columbia. And presumably the US part of that range, it looks like it's less intense and the ecosystem there is more adapted to the presence of these beetles, and now they've kind of suddenly migrated north and really had an effect on ecosystems that are not adapted to that presence.
But you see almost that same coloration when you drive through Idaho and western Montana. Mm-hmm. So it still is as intense mm-hmm. there as you see it here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so actually I guess I'll throw out what kind of adaptation actions might be taken in this case. I don't think it's easy, but...
is there something that preys on it? Something that...
We need to harvest more timber.
Oh, yeah, cut down the trees.
Uh-huh.
If you reduce the size of the timber stands to shrink the area that the beetle can survive in, you might have a chance of trying to control it some.
Okay. Okay, and then any ideas for trying to replace those stands with something else?
Other species that are showing the ability to survive at the warmer, wetter climate.
Yeah, and I kind of suspect it sort of needs to be entire ecosystems transplanted
yep.
there.
Yep.
Mm. Yeah, and you know that feels unnatural. But maybe it's necessary.
It's happening naturally to some degree, but if we really want to benefit from the whole process, we probably have to try and accelerate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, it kind of reminds me of what's happening more accidentally in the Great Lakes with this most famous invasive species is the zebra mussels,
and right.
Really those are being supplanted now by their close relative, the quagga mussel.
Well, yeah.
And there actually is a whole array of other invasive species that are making the Great Lakes ecosystem kind of a copy of the Black and Caspian seas. Yeah.
So fire also kills the beetles.
Uh-huh.
So more, I mean, to an extent, obviously more controlled burns. Because the problem is that these trees, when they get like that, then
yeah.
you have just intense fires that just
right. have a real risk of,
you know, blow up the whole forest. But if you somehow get into a management system that can for some tracts of land, expose the trees to fires that kills off the beetles, you might have a chance.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, so I didn't prepare a slide on this, but it was kind of mentioned in the, what I'll call the abstract, the description of this, but crop yields are at risk. Because that's a human-managed system, maybe the adaptation will be a little easier. Plant a different variety of crops, and people have sort of proposed that that crops can migrate to the north, and maybe that's of benefit to places in Saskatchewan that have had a short growing season, but there are certain places that have been considered inadequate for growing crops that the reason really is not their climate but their soil. So you're not going to benefit those kind of areas. So let's go on to talk about.
Well, what was the conclusion of the paper? Was there adaptation?
There have been a number of papers on that. Kind of the general outline is some areas that are growing crops will benefit. Others can kind of switch to different kinds of crops and be okay.
Well, I meant for the pine beetle.
Oh, for the pine beetle?
Yeah.
I don't think there's actually a whole adaptation scheme that's proposed there.
Hmm.
So sea level rise, these are general projections and history of sea levels, and it's actually showing that there's a history of global mean sea level rise. This is coming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fourth Assessment Report of 2007. So it's showing what's historically known, and the zero line here is actually the 2007 level, and this is in millimeters. I can get on my soapbox about the metric system for you if you want to.
2.54 centimeters per inch. So.
Yeah. So, 500 millimeters is, what is that? That's, I'm blanking out. That's about 20 inches.
Yeah.
So projections for the future actually cover a large range when you go up to 2100. It's between 200 and 500 millimeters, so that's 8 to 20 inches. A wide range, and there are basically two components to this projected sea level rise. One of them is expansion of the water in the oceans due to its becoming warmer. It becomes less dense and occupies more space, therefore the level of it has to rise. And the other, which has a greater degree of uncertainty, is melting of glaciers that are on land. So I mentioned, I forget which night it was, that it's been a surprise just how fast the ice on Greenland has been melting, and that's really been realized over the last decade. And it's, despite the lack of increase in global temperatures over the past 15 years, the rate of melt of Greenland ice has kept pace.
NPR yesterday, the forecast rise in sea level by the end of this century was 20 feet.
Wow. Yeah, that's huge. That's way beyond.
Yes.
This projection shows here.
It was on NPR. I don't remember what the source was, but they were quoting science comments about the rise in sea level, and they were projecting at the end of this century a 20-foot rise in sea level.
Okay.
You could go to online.
Did you hear a name associated with it?
I could go online to NPR and probably track it that way.
Okay, well, the next chart shows Florida and part of the Gulf Coast under a 2-foot rise in sea level. So this one's using English units. So this is showing this part of Louisiana around New Orleans being underwater, and some pieces of southern Florida and a lot of these barrier islands along Florida. So I guess we've brought up the idea of hurricanes. Actually, I'm going to be talking about that later, but even without any change in hurricanes, these sea level rises put more places in danger to even the present frequency of hurricanes. And further north, Hurricane Sandy hit the Jersey Shore really hard, and that's made up of barrier islands, kind of similar to the shoreline of Florida. So let's talk about adaptation measures for a place like Miami or even the New Jersey shore that depend on tourism associated with their beaches. So yeah, these are difficult kinds of adaptation. So for a place like New York City, it's more feasible and less damaging to the economy to build seawalls to keep the water from coming in. But when the beach is your economy, those seawalls destroy the beach. So yeah, some places are going to have easier and more palatable plans for adaptation than others.
So and what do you think they are, what are their plans, or what have you heard?
Well, beach enrichment has been used in a whole lot of places, just hauling in more sand, and you know, that's something that you just have to keep doing if you start getting more and more damage there, and you want to maintain that beach. And you know, in a lot of these places, it's whole islands that you're trying to maintain. And yeah, some of those islands in Miami and Jersey Shore is where I've been more often. It's been quite a while though. And those islands are built up, so they've got valuable real estate on them, and people want to protect that. And yet, yeah, it might be like Sisyphus trying to roll the rock up the hill.
Yes, I live pretty close to that area, and Sandy has really begun a major conversation in the whole area, and there are pretty strong efforts in place for swaths of New Jersey Shore not to be rebuilt.
Hmm.
Not to be rebuilt. And places that have refused to have dunes in the past are now being required to have dunes,
mm-hmm.
and beach grasses and such put in, because before they destroyed the view. No, it's
interesting.
So it's already happening.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Take another sandy or two, and it'll be moving faster, I think.
Yeah. So those are adaptation mm-hmm. examples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when it's like economically feasible, I would think, you know, New York City and how the storm surge or whatever, you know, flooded downtown Manhattan. I mean, do you think that might? I know it. It's one storm, it's not
mm-hmm.
climate change, but it might get people thinking just because of the amount of damage and where
yeah.
it, you know. And,
did you know that Hurricane Sandy produced a storm surge in Toledo, Ohio?
I do, I was there. I was out.
You were there?
I was out of Ohio when it hit.
Toledo?
I was 50 miles east of Toledo, but yeah, it was major, and all, and I had relatives trying to get home to to South Carolina through huge snowstorms. It was just massive.
Yeah, it was a really strong wind out of the northeast, and it put a storm surge right into
electricity was out all over the place.
Yeah, so I guess that's sort of a segue to the Great Lakes levels here, and this is something that I showed before. Some of the means of adaptation in the Great Lakes, one that's really already in place. So for those who weren't here on Wednesday, what's on the left of this diagram is the historical Great Lakes levels starting in 1999, and Lake Superior, Lakes Michigan, and Huron in the middle, and Lake Erie over here. So those are the historical levels, and these over here, the green boxes sort of show ranges of projections out into the future of Great Lakes levels. The orange bars are projections from a different source, and these that include the annual oscillations are my projections. Yeah, and if you look up at the top at Lake Superior, the range of possibilities shown there is much narrower than the others, and the main reason for that is because of what's already in place, the outlet of Lake Superior is regulated. So there are treaties between the U.S. and Canada that govern how much water is let out of Lake Superior under certain conditions, and one of the major criteria is to keep the lake level within a fairly small range. Hmm.
So what are the two different shades that you have on your projection?
Those are using different climate models as input.
Okay.
Could you help with the numbers and the dates in the bottom? I can't
quote. Oh, okay. Yeah, this is 1999 at this end. This is 2099 over here. And let's see now, this is a range. This is in meters from 172 up to 172.8 up to 175.4. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's increments of 0.4 meters. So yeah, this is a range of almost 3 meters for the full scale here. Some of the projections of drops in lake levels, especially this one right here, is about a meter and
Michigan.
A half. Yeah, Michigan and Huron.
And both of them.
Yeah, they're one lake. They're connected by the Straits of Mackinac, which is it's a little bit narrow but very deep, and they maintain the same level. Barring sort of a storm surge type of phenomenon, that they have the same level.
So why does one decrease and one increase with your different climate models?
It's because the climate that is simulated by those models for this locality differs between those two models, and the main difference is the amount of precipitation. So this lake level is dependent on the difference between precipitation and evaporation, and again, those are two different quantities with uncertainties associated with them. If you subtract them, kind of the relative uncertainty grows even larger. You can really get a range of values in here. But getting back to the adaptation, One of the pieces is using the regulation of Lake Superior. Another thing that's been proposed and so far rejected is to regulate the outlet of Lake Huron. And that's probably going to be proposed again, and we'll see if it ever actually happens.
Why was it rejected?
It's deemed unnecessary and unnatural. So, yeah, it could be happening in the future. Climate is one of the things that is affecting this, and there are also a lot of people who believe that there was some sort of sudden erosion event in the St. Clair River, which is the outlet of Lake Huron, and that was something that caused a big drop in lake levels in the late 1990s. So that's kind of on the basis of rumor, but hasn't been very thoroughly disproved.
Hmm. What is the sesh activity in Lake Huron?
Lake Huron doesn't have much. Lake Erie does.
Okay.
So, yeah, Hurricane Sandy was one example of that. I don't know the dates of this. I heard about it from one of my colleagues, but there was one time when, first let me explain the connection, the waterway connection between Lake Huron and Lake Erie consists of kind of three pieces. One is the St. Clair River, which flows directly out of Lake Huron. Then there's Lake St. Clair, which is on Detroit and a little bit to the north of it. So that's part of the whole Great Lakes flow system, but it's a much smaller lake. And then the Detroit River flows out of Lake St. Clair, and that flows into Lake Erie. So there are those pieces of the connection. And one time there was such a strong storm surge in Lake Erie that the Detroit River flowed backward.
Mm.
Wow.
So, getting back to adaptation, there are several different groups that have interests in Great Lakes levels. One of the most economically important is the shipping industry, and low lake levels force them to carry lighter loads in their ships in order to get into the ports, and that costs money for them. On the other hand, higher lake levels give them an advantage. And then tourism and shoreline property owners are important in a lot of those places. It's an economic activity. Within limits, the shoreline property owners kind of like the water low. That gives them more beach.
But they also want to armor their beaches.
Yeah, a lot of places they really armor the shorelines, and especially in that what we call the Huron Erie corridor along Detroit, and yeah, a lot of the urban shoreline areas.
I spent most of Tuesday testifying before the Shoreline Hearing Board here in the state of Washington on shoreline issues associated with bulkheading.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So what do you mean by armored?
Large boulders placed along the shoreline to stop any change in the shoreline.
Seawall.
Yeah.
Seawall.
Or boulders. Or concrete. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any projections on the change in the ecology and fish in the lakes with the change in global temperatures, how it's going to affect fishing and the ecosystems of the lakes? just the resin?
Yeah, you know, in the Great Lakes, there have been some studies on that, but I'm feeling like they're not all that complete. I've sort of been involved in two of those, and one of those used quite simple arguments to say there's a longer, with warming, there's kind of a longer season when certain species of fish can be at their optimal temperature. And the only difference is that might be a little bit deeper in the water column during midsummer, but the fish are able to migrate vertically so they can find their optimum temperature. And that was kind of one argument taken in isolation that probably doesn't tell the whole story. Another one more recently was what they call a bioenergetics model, and that basically showed very little sensitivity among the species that were investigated.
So what sort of temperature changes are we talking about?
We're talking about temperature changes in the epilimnion, which is the top layer of the water, of 3 or 4 degrees Celsius.
That's quite large.
Yeah.
In Puget Sound, that would be devastating.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I guess another thing I wanted to mention with the lake levels is that nearshore spawning grounds, where the fish like to lay their eggs, are dependent on lake levels. And people have sort of regarded the optimum for that as consisting of a relatively large amount of time variability in that. So it's not so much about the average lake level, it's more about that it needs to be changing from year to year. Okay, so education is important. People will implement adaptation measures, and they need to understand how climate changes will affect their situation and what are the uncertainties that are involved. The stakeholders need to be directly involved in the plan for adaptation, so the users have buy-in. They're helping to formulate the plan, and so involves two-way interaction with climate scientists. And one of the problems with this is climate scientists usually don't have much incentive to engage in this kind of activity.
Why not?
Because what they're expected to do is write papers about climate. Mm-hmm. And
publish or perish.
That's right. Yeah, so their bosses are telling them to do something else. So policies should anticipate what needs to be done, but be modifiable, be flexible based on new conditions and lessons learned. And I think this is, we'll get down to the last point here. Jump ahead. Adaptation is local, so the question of who decides is much simpler. So it's easier to implement a more flexible type of policy, because there won't be as many multiple governmental entities involved and international entities in most cases. So stakeholders need to help decide what their plan is. And this third one, you don't have to actually blame your climate change on greenhouse gases in order to have adaptation as a logical step. You can be one of those people who says, well, I think climate really is changing, but it's not humans doing it. You can still think that adaptation is effective, and you might even use the term enhancing resilience to a variety of problems. So aside from warming of the climate. So again, to reiterate that last point, adaptation tends to be more local. So in contrast to what we were talking about last night, where you really need an international solution to mitigation of climate change on a global scale, these sort of decisions can be made by cities, by companies, or by states, or the appropriate sized group. So at this point, I think I'll pause a little bit for discussion, and then prompted by conversation with Brian this morning, we'll talk a little bit about tropical cyclones.
In terms of your bottom bullet and what's happening in the Puget Sound region is, it would seem like local decision making would be easy. But unfortunately, the cities are required that are on shorelines of Puget Sound, and the lakes for that matter, are required to develop shoreline master plans. And those are prepared by the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And because the shorelines are basically the basic economic backbone of the property owners of the shoreline, they refuse to accept environmentally sound decisions as to what should be or shouldn't be done on the shoreline. They want to have the ability to use the shoreline any way they want. And it does have a very significant environmental, in some cases very adverse environmental impact on the health of Puget Sound. So it hasn't been an easy process. And the state mandates the changes, but then enforcement comes back to the city.
Yeah.
And when your shoreline property owners are very wealthy people, management in that environment is very litigious.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess we'll have to qualify this by saying the interests of the local people, whether they be favorable to the broader set of environmental concerns, are what's going to rule the type of adaptation that's going to be attempted.
Right.
Any other discussion, questions?
Well, it just seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but intuitively, adaptation is going to be inadequate, and am I thinking correctly? It just seems, you know, people react, but they don't react until they have big problems brought on, and then they react, and like Wayne said, it's so difficult to get things changed, even if you're trying to adapt. It just seems to me that adaptation is inadequate. Anybody else feel that way?
Well, as an environmental scientist, the thing that's frightening for me is the rate of change in climate and climate conditions in the last decade has so accelerated that adaptive management is one that takes time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if we're going to rely on adaptive management, I think there needs to be some qualifiers in how you approach that from mandatory management to go along with your adaptive management.
I mean, it just seems like band-aids.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not solving.
You need surgery.
The mm-hmm. underlying problems.
Yeah, so I guess the first time I really went to a meeting that was specifically about climate change adaptation, they brought up the thing about managing the unpreventable and preventing the unmanageable. And said that, well, we've kind of reached a point where previously adaptation was thought of as selling out to the idea that you can't do anything to prevent climate change mitigation, and the statement was made that in order to be realistic, you have to include some of these adaptation type of options. And yeah, you're right. It's band-aids. And I guess we have to hope that things won't become completely unmanageable. And we might have to just give up on certain things, like the Everglades. Yeah, then I'll just go ahead to the next slide, which is a short bit that doesn't really fit with the rest of what I've been presenting tonight, but I thought I'd add it because of what I was talking to Brian about today. So tropical cyclones or hurricanes have caused some controversy within the community as far as how they're affected by climate change. I'll remind you about sort of the uncertainty talks that I gave earlier, which said that the overall framework of climate change, the global scale warming, is very strongly scientifically supported. And yeah, actually 8:30 is my quitting time, isn't it? I was thinking 8:45. All right. I'll make this quick. So the overall idea of global warming is very strongly scientifically supported. Some of the individual impacts of it are more uncertain. And tropical cyclones are one example. So in the past, it was thought to be caused by warm ocean water, and this was supported by a positive correlation with water surface temperature, between water surface temperature and tropical cyclone activity. Tropical cyclones is the more generic term that describes things around the world, which locally are called hurricanes, typhoons, cyclones, and a few other things. So there's an adage that says correlation is not equal to causation. So these are correlated in historical data, but you can also say I'm going to take the water temperature minus the air temperature averaged over some areas, you get a very similar correlation with tropical cyclones when you use that measure. So the first of those, just plain ocean surface temperature, is projected to increase in the future. Ocean surface temperature minus air temperature is projected to stay pretty much the same. So the question is, which of those measures do you use to project tropical cyclone activity in the future? And people who specialize in this have debated it a whole lot, and one guy actually quit his post as a lead writer in the International Panel for Climate Change, Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, the fourth assessment report. He was a lead author of one of the chapters, and he got so frustrated with the coordinator of the whole volume, who was making statements about potential for tropical cyclones. This guy wrote an open letter to anyone who wanted to read it and said, I'm no longer going to do this because this guy's contradicting me. I'm not going to be an author for this international document that that actually won the Nobel Peace Prize. So the guy who quit was kind of in the camp of the second method, and the one who is the editor of the whole volume kind of used the first argument. And what has kind of emerged as a compromise, sort of a consensus, is to say that the intensity of tropical cyclones is likely to increase, not their frequency. The 2005 hurricane season drew a lot of attention to this in the United States, and one of the reasons for that was because major hurricanes made landfall in the United States in that season. There actually were a lot of Atlantic hurricanes that year, but not so in the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Several major ones hit the United States, so that's what gets press in the U.S. But in any case, this sort of compromise was reached. And some people are still convinced otherwise, that this compromise isn't quite the right answer, but that's how it is. Another thing that occurred to me in talking to Brian was that people were trying to look at historical records of hurricane intensity in the Atlantic Ocean and were not allowing for the difference between observation in the pre-satellite era and post-satellite era. So before there were satellites, there could be hurricanes out in the middle of the ocean that no one realized were there.
So now intensity would be measured in wind speeds, the size of them?
Yeah, wind speed would be, the kind of professional definition of that involves wind speed multiplied by the area that it's occurring and the height of it. So it's kind of a total kinetic energy of the whole system.
And then we have, increasing damage too. I mean, that's not intensity in that way, but hitting major, really developed places.
Yeah, and one of the factors behind that is increased development of places that are risked from hurricanes and repeated redevelopment of them after they've already been hit by a hurricane.
A 100-year floodplain.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming throughout the week for these folks.
Thank you, Brent.
Are you going to be doing it?